Welcome to the Disciple Makers Podcast, featuring biblical teaching from Disciple Makers Ministry to college students. We are continuing with a series of breakout sessions from the 2015 Disciple Makers Fall Conference. Mike Chartowich takes the opportunity to answer an age-old question with his talk entitled, Is the Bible Trustworthy?
I'm thinking if you're here and you're a little skeptical of the Bible, of Christianity, I think this is why I put this together, to help you maybe a little bit in seeing some of the evidence for the Bible itself, which is a foundational book for Christianity. And so hopefully this will help you. And if you are a Christian already, then this should encourage you and maybe give you some things that you could share with others as well. And they ask these questions, is the Bible really trustworthy? All right. Well, one thing I mentioned I was a philosophy major, and I found this at a used bookstore. And it's actually a book, it's like a textbook, intro book to philosophy, that was written by two of my professors. I was looking at the names, I'm like, wait a second, these are like two of my philosophy professors that I had. And so I was excited to look through. I'm like, they're stepping up, they're getting their own books published, this is cool. And I had both of them for my classes. And so I started reading through this book, and a lot of the basic intro level articles are in here that any philosophy student would study. But then I opened up, and there was one article in here, and I got pretty distressed when I saw it. It says, the title is False Testament: Archaeology Refutes the Bible's Claim to History. And I'm like, what? And I read through it, and I was like, I was pretty disturbed by the lack of scholarship of this article. And then, in all philosophy books, what you'll have is you'll have like a pro and a con, different sides of the debate. So I'm like, okay, well, let me read to where the pro article is. Guess what? There's none. It goes right to the problem of evil. So I was like, I started to get a little bit annoyed. I'm like, wait a second. Why do they have an article which I feel is not even a scholarly article compared to all the other articles in the book? And they don't even have one that refutes it or it gives the opposite viewpoint. Just basically says that the whole Bible is been constructed, and most of it is mythological, particularly the Old Testament. And I don't know about you, but maybe you've had that experience where people have said, the Bible, you can't trust that. You can't trust that. It's a book of myths. It's not historical. You might have heard that in your classes, or maybe friends will raise those objections. Well, what I want to talk about today is the fact that the Bible is trustworthy, that there is good reasons to believe that it's actually portraying what happened in the past. When we compare it to other historical research, and that since the Bible is trustworthy, that we should consider its claims. We should consider its claims, that what it says about God and about Jesus. And because you might have been here at the other session, you might have said, I can see God in nature. There is something about nature that seems to point beyond itself to something more. But what about the Bible? Right? You might be like, have questions about the Bible. So that's what we're going to tackle this morning. This is the other way that we get to know God, is through God's revelation in the Bible. So we're going to do that by looking at three points here this afternoon. One is that the Bible is a trustworthy document. The Bible is a trustworthy document that when we look at other documents and compare it to other historical documents, we're going to see the Bible stacks up extremely well, actually better than other documents in history. Secondly, though, that what it actually says gives us a trustworthy look into the past. And from what we can test, we can see that there is a real accuracy there to history. And thirdly, we'll just wrap up with looking at just how the Bible actually portrays the events in humanity and God. Gives us, it's something that we can look at and say, yeah, that seems to make sense. That is a trustworthy portrayal of the way things are. So those are the three things we're going to look at. And if you have questions, I'm going to leave some time for questions at the end. So we can just have mic runners and we can do questions at the end, okay? So if you have a question, just note it down and we'll do it. And I'll try to answer the best I can. So, all right, well, let's dig in here and talk first about the Bible being a trustworthy document. There's been a lot of criticism about the Bible. And there's many books out right now that are challenging the actual writings of the Bible. Right? Because if we can't actually trust what's been written, that maybe it's been changed over time, maybe it's been fabricated, etc., then we can't really trust anything that it says. And a lot of people will criticize the Bible in that way. So when we look at the Bible, what do we see? How will we investigate the actual background and the history of it? Well, I think there's a couple of things that when we look at them, we can actually see, like I said, the Bible stacks up extremely well compared to other history that we look at. So first is the age of the documents. Now, why is this important? Well, any historian, you know, will tell you that when you look at when the national event happens versus when it was written down, the longer the time gap between the event and the writing, the less, you know, confidence. It gives you a little bit less confidence that what actually happened in that event is represented in the text. Well, why would that be? Well, because, right, over time, maybe there's been errors in the documents. Maybe it's been slowly changed over time. You know, and so as we look at this, you would say, well, if there's like a lot of age gap, it makes you trust the text less. Well, what about the Bible? Well, when we look at the Bible, we actually can see that it stacks up extremely well, right? So now I list in this chart here, you have a bunch of other famous histories that most people would not question to a large degree, that there's historical accuracy and data in these other texts, okay? And the Bible's bolded at the bottom. Now, when we look at the Bible and we look compared to these other texts, you see as far as the earliest copies of many of these texts, we see that there can be anywhere from several hundred to almost 1,000 years in between when the text was written and when the earliest copies actually are known. When we look at the New Testament of the Bible, we see that there's actually only, the earliest copies go all the way back to 125 AD, right? And this can be anywhere, depending on some of the early dating of the books and when they're actually written, 25 to 50 years after they were written. Now, most that early are mostly fragments. They're not complete books. But even in those fragments, when we stack it up and look at it against what we have today in the Bible, we see there's an extreme accuracy and connection to it. And that most of the Bible, actually, we have most of the text, we have full text up to about 200 years before, after they were actually written. 100 to 200 years, we have the full text of all the documents in the Bible. Because remember, the Bible is not written by one author, it's actually a compilation of several books. Right, so we look at this, and like a lot of these other histories, like, you know, Plato and Tacitus and all these other, they're not seriously questioned by scholars, and yet there's these magnificent time gaps between them. But the Bible is often criticized, but yet it's actually much closer. The actual documents have go much closer to the original writing. So that's one thing that we see that I think the Bible gives us good reason. And this is one example, the Chester Beatty papyrus. It goes back to 200 AD, and actually this is one section. This actual section is one section of the book of 1 Corinthians. It was written around 200 AD, but actually there was many other full biblical books that were found with this document here. So that's just one example, what we see here. And you know, you can write these down, note them, and then look them up yourself later. So we see that the age of the document stacks up, but secondly, the amount of documents. Not just the age of them, but the amount of them. Why is that important, the amount of documents that we have? Well, like I said, when you look, let's go back to that chart. When we look at the chart, we can see that compared to the amount of copies that we have, compared to the Bible has over 24,000 full copies and also manuscript copies that we have that go back within several hundred years of when it was written. When you can stack that up again, you're going to see that these other histories are much less, much less. And well, why is that helpful? Well, the reason why that's helpful is because when you have many different copies, you can actually start to look at it and say, well, maybe some of the scribes made errors. Maybe they made mistakes as they were put writing, because sometimes like everything had to be copied by hand back then. Can you imagine like copying like a full book of the Bible by hand? Like, I don't know, talk about tedious, right? But I guess these guys, hopefully they paid them well to do that job. Because I would never want to do that. But you know, occasionally small errors are going to be made. And so the question is, well, can we trust the Bible, right? Because maybe these errors have just crept in over time. Like a bad photocopy that keeps getting copied over and over again, right? It gets worse and worse every time it's copied. Well, see, the thing is, when you look at the Bible, we see that because there's so many different copies, and not only is there many different copies that we can compare and say, well, oh, look, this one seems like a copying error started to arise. Well, this one didn't have it, and this one is earlier than another one, so this probably is more closer to what was originally written. That when we start to do that, that gives us more ability to check and cross-check those documents. And another thing about the Bible, too, is the Bible did not only originate when the original documents were written by the apostles and disciples of Jesus. These books then were copied and spread throughout the Mediterranean. So they were copied and recopied in different cultures. So that actually that diversity gives us ways to go back and check and see how were they copied in different areas. So really the Bible, it's really interesting. You see like this vast corpus of texts that we can check and verify. And so we see that the amount of documents is better than any other really reputable historical text. So we have the age and the amount of the documents, but also the accuracy of the documents themselves. And when you look at this, you're going to see that when we actually take what we have written in later, what you have in your Bible now, and we compare it to these documents that go close to when they are actually written, particularly the New Testament, you're going to see that there's very little differences between them. And this is important because a lot of criticisms today, and like Bart Ehrman, who's written some books criticizing the New Testament, he's a New Testament scholar, they often will argue that the Bible was changed because of theological biases. Right, so certain groups of Christianity were winning or competing with each other, and so the winning group basically interpreted Jesus and God and things about him the way they wanted, and so they wrote, they manipulated the Bible and the text to fit their theology. But the thing is, though, when we can go so close to the original sources, and we can actually look and say, okay, was it changed? Were they changed? Like, they weren't. They weren't. There's only small discrepancies. And one thing is interesting, if you look at your Bibles, oftentimes you'll see sometimes little text notes and you go down. And even if there's like some dispute about how a text should be written, it's actually in the bottom of your Bible. It says, okay, well, another variant reading could be this or this. Right? And so the Bible is actually, and the Bible translators are honest with, if there are variant readings, here they are. Here's the possible different readings. Some other religious traditions, they don't allow any questions like that about their texts. And they don't even allow this type of scrutiny of their text. But in the Christian tradition, the texts have been scrutinized over and over and over and over again to their accuracy. And one amazing thing that happened, and I'm going to mention different things in archaeology, and we have some, I think one or two of our staff that were on a trip to Israel that just saw some of this archaeology for themselves, which I'm pretty jealous about. I would love to go do that. One amazing discovery with the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of you might have heard about them. They were found, it's the southern port along the Dead Sea. There's these caves along in this kind of a separate sect of Judaism. And they found, it was amazing, like in 1948, they became to the attention of scholars that these caves existed and they found documents there. And I've been talking about the New Testament, but actually the Old Testament, you see, it goes further back in history. So the question, well, what about the Old Testament? And up until that point, we had only had information up text only about 1,000 years, 1,000 AD, right? So it was like there's a long time gap between when they were written and when they actually existed. But Randall Price, who's a scholar, he said this. He says, "But the biblical texts in the scrolls close this 1,000-year gap, and let us compare the Hebrew text behind our translations with those, in some cases, only a generation from the originals. This comparison revealed, amazingly, almost identical wording. So from our new knowledge of the text based on the scrolls, we can approach our own Bible translations with greater confidence." Right? So you guys can have strong confidence that what you're actually reading was what was actually written. Now, you might say, okay, well, great, that's nice. That's nice, I can have confidence in that. That maybe clears away some objections that it's been changed or manipulated over time by people. But what about though, the history itself? Because like one of the problems is like, well, I don't know if I trust what it says. It might be accurate to what was written, but what about what it actually says? Well, that's why we want to look at and say that the Bible is actually a trustworthy history. It's not just a trustworthy document, but it's actually a trustworthy history, okay? Now, one of the ways we can verify things historically is by looking at other sources outside the text itself. Now, that sort of, sometimes I struggle with that because people will say, well, yeah, the Bible says this, but how come there's no other references to Jesus or God? I'm like, well, we only have four gospels, right? That's not just one testimony. We have four gospels that talk about Jesus. And we have multiple other books and witnesses. So it wasn't just one person making this up or claiming things, right? And a lot of other religions, say, such as like Islam and Mormonism, they only have one person that actually received the revelation and all the writings came from that one person. In the Bible, you have multiple people writing these things down, and their stories corroborating with one another. But you'd say, well, what about, like, those people are biased. So is there any other evidence out there that confirms the Bible, that's outside the Bible itself? And there is some of that evidence. So when we talk about the Old Testament, I just read this interesting article. Let me get the journal. If you're interested in any of this, in archaeology or history, I would recommend this. It's called Biblical Archaeological Review. And this is written from various perspectives. This is not like a Christian or Jewish journal. There's people who are pro and con about the Bible. But in this issue, one of the authors writes an article about 50 real people that are names that are in the Bible that have been verified in other sources in history and archaeology. So he goes through this list, and I was going to try to put it up there, but there's so much, it just doesn't look good. It's like so squashed. I can show it to you later if you want afterwards. But he lists all these from Egypt, from Assyria, from Babylon, that all these different kings and rulers are mentioned in other texts and other cultures, and some of them actually mention the Hebrew and the Jewish kings of Israel and Judah in them. And so when you match them, you're like, okay, the Bible is actually recording actual history, right? This is not just a book of myths. Like, whenever you're faced and reading the Bible, you realize, like, they're recording real events and real history, right? It's not just simply a myth. And when you look at other books and you actually read things that are myth, they have a totally different feel to them. They say things that seem to be completely implausible in and of themselves, not just miracles, but other things. Like, when you read the Epic of Gilgamesh, which records a flood story that's similar to Genesis, but very different, one thing that stands out is when you read it, the dimensions it gives for the Noah's Ark, for the ark that Noah builds to escape the flood, the dimensions are actually dimensions of a cube. And then people are like, okay, if you know anything about boats that are seaworthy, when you put a boat in the water, a cube is not seaworthy. It just capsizes and floats. But actually, the dimensions of Noah's Ark is actually a seaworthy vessel. Like, you could build it to that dimension, and it actually could be a seaworthy vessel. And when you see myths, right, myths don't have those kind of details. They actually start to embellish things and change things. But the Bible is actually mentioning real people in real places. That's in the Old Testament. Also, in the New Testament, you have confirmation of Jesus' death and that he lived and that he was executed. Right? Because some people have questioned, like, well, did Jesus even really live? Maybe he's just completely fabricated and made up. Well, one of the historians that was on that chart, Tacitus, he's a Roman historian. He wrote from AD 50, he lived from AD 55 to 120. He references Jesus in his biography of Nero. And he says this about Nero, and basically what was happening is Nero, who was a very unstable ruler, if you've read anything about him, and one thing he did is he actually set fire to part of the city. But most people at that time said that he's actually caused the fire, but he blamed it on Christians, that Christians were responsible, and Christians were actually persecuted and killed, and some of them executed because of this. Listen to what Tacitus says, and right, he's not a Christian at all. Neither of these references are Christians. He says, consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom their name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, which just means governor, Pontius Pilate. And a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome. Right? So we see here that he actually, what the Bible says about Pontius Pilate being the ruler, then we can verify that through other sources. They ruled that Jesus was actually executed and that this Christian religion was actually spread and that Jesus was the source of the religion, right? So we have one mention of Jesus. Another one is Flavius Josephus. He was a Jewish historian. He actually went and worked for the Romans after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And this is right during the time of Jesus, right during the early church and the time of the Christianity spreading. He said this about Jesus. He says, "At this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and the other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die. And those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he had appeared to them after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders." Right, so we learn a lot of facts even just from these small references in other historians, right? And these are not Christian historians, right? We have a Roman, probably a secular historian, and then Josephus, who's Jewish, just reporting the facts about what happened, about Jesus, what happened to him, and to the early church. So this is actually, you know, if when you have myths, you don't have corresponding history like that. You don't have historians writing about myths like that. And people being officially executed. You can't execute a myth, right? Jesus is real. He was a real person. He really lived. So not only do we get just other historical documents, but we also get confirmations from archaeology. And this is really, really fun. One of them is Hezekiah's tunnel. And I know Dave, he's actually going to start in a minute here. Dave Kiefer is sitting in the back. Hezekiah's tunnel, it was actually during the reign of King Hezekiah, you'll see it in the book of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. Hezekiah was under siege. The Jewish nation was under siege by an Assyrian king called Sennacherib. And what they needed to do was build up the fortifications and prepare for this coming invasion that was happening. And so what they did is they constructed a way to get water in the city because it's extremely dry there. And this says this in 2 Kings 20:20. It says, "The rest of the deeds of Hezekiah and all his might, and how he made the pool and the conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Judah?" And actually what was discovered is they found this conduit and the pools that were related to him. The pools were always there, but the actual tunnels were. Now, it's a little hard to see probably at that distance, but there's some of our illustrious staff on their trip to Dave Kiefer. You see him in the back there. He's on the right, and Ben Hagrup. Melissa is there as well. Who's that other lady, Dave? I don't even know. That's your mom? She came. I didn't know she came. Wow, awesome. But they did you guys actually go through the tunnel? Right. Yes. Yeah. So this there was actually an inscription in there that talked about it, and this tunnel actually dates to the time of Hezekiah's reign. Now, there's been some debate on that. Some scholars doubt it, but the evidence is pretty strong that this is actually dated to that time. And so, it's kind of exciting because when you actually look at the Bible, you start to see there's actually real physical things that we can discover through archaeology. And that's what's great about archaeology is because the archaeology, the physical remains are there. Right, you could say, well, a historian made it up, but when you actually start getting to the physical remains, that becomes exciting. Right, so you have Hezekiah's tunnel was discovered and verified, and also the other events around that siege are also recorded in the Assyrian history as well. Although what happened is, like, God struck down 185,000 of the Assyrians, and so they had to break off their siege to Jerusalem. And the king Sennacherib, when he recorded it, he said, he goes, "Well, I had Hezekiah caught up and locked up in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage." But in his history, he never says that he conquered the city. He conquered all these other cities in Israel, but he never conquered that city. So you can see he, like, you know, boasted. But Sennacherib was assassinated not long after that. Many people thinking because of that extreme failure, spectacular failure, he was killed by his own people. And that's recorded in Assyrian history as well. So it's really fascinating when we start seeing this. Another one that's interesting, well, there's that's how long the tunnel was. And they did this with like pickaxes by hand. It's like, I forget exactly how long. I think it's like 2,000 feet or something like that. It's extremely, and it just snaked through and made it all the way to the pool. And that allowed them to have water during the siege of their city. So we have Hezekiah's tunnel. We also have the pool of Bethesda. And this is recorded in John chapter 5, verses 1 through 2. John 5, 1 through 2. This is where Jesus heals a paralyzed man. And it says this: after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, in Aramaic called Bethesda, which had five roof colonnades. And part of this was... Part of this was that scholars were always wondering, like, well, what about these five roof colonnades? Because most pools, so they'd be square, and so you'd have four roof colonnades, and these would be where you'd have pillars, and you could sit underneath them and get into the water. Listen to what it says here. It says, for centuries, scholars thought that the notion of a five-sided pool was purely symbolic, intended to represent the five books of the Torah that were somehow superseded by the miracle of Jesus. Beginning in the 1880s, however, archaeologists discovered the remains of a pool north of the Pool of Israel, and continued excavation ultimately exposing a rectangular pool with a wall in the middle that divided it in two, with porticos on four sides of the pool, and on the central wall, this was indeed a five-sided pool. And here's like a reconstruction of it. They can't completely excavate the whole thing because people's houses are over the site. So, you know, unfortunately, we can't excavate the whole thing. But the way they realized is that there was actually two pools and there was a central wall in between. So actually, it has, in a sense, five-sided with the four outside walls and then the fifth one in the center. And that's what John was actually referring to. A lot of people thought, oh, John, like, I mean, what was he talking about? Like, but even this small detail is recorded, and that actually is verified through archaeology and what we discovered. And you start to say, okay, I'm starting to see a real document talking about real historical things. Let me just give you one more. The Tel Dan Stele. The Tel Dan Stele. Now, this is actually from my textbook. Okay, this quote is from my textbook, the one that infuriated me. It said, this is what he says, the Davidic Empire, so David in the Bible, which archaeologists once thought as incontrovertible as the Roman, is now seen as an invention of Jerusalem-based priests in the 7th or 8th centuries BC, who were eager to burnish their national history. Right, so there's several theories out there advocated by people called biblical minimalists. That's sort of like their nickname. They basically think not too much about the Bible is actually accurate. Most of it was actually made up over time and for political reasons, for religious reasons. And so many of them thought like David was actually just a myth, right? You have to think about it. This valiant, you know, incredible character who slays Goliath and he rises and he has all these adventures and it's a perfect thing of myth. Right, and so they didn't think David actually existed. Well, actually, in at Tel Dan, right, this is in northern, really at the northern tip of Israel. It was a city, and a tel just means like a mound. So most of these cities over time, because they were occupied at different times in history, they would kind of knock down what was there and they would keep building on them. So there's actually a lot of archaeology. When you go down through all the levels, you're going to start to see the civilizations that are earlier. This stone was actually just taken from something else and built into a wall. So they would just use pieces of stone that were usable, and they didn't care about the inscription. And this was a non-Jewish, you know, non-Hebrew king who set up this inscription, boasting about his victory over Israel, the king of Israel and the king of Judah. And so, but they actually found this stone. And when archaeologists started deciphering it, they realized, and this was in 1993, they realized that it mentions the house of Israel and the house of David, right? It mentions Israel as a nation, and it mentions the house of David, which basically just means like the lineage of David. And this was remarkable. People were pretty astounded by this. And this is from a Biblical Archaeological Review. said, for many scholars, and especially the broader public, what was exciting about the stele was its unprecedented reference to the house of David. The stele's fragmented inscription, first read and translated by the renowned epigrapher, I don't know, am I saying that right? Joseph Nave proved once and for all that David was a genuine historical figure and not simply the fantastic literary creation of later biblical writers and editors. So when we start seeing this, we start seeing that the Bible is more and more history is being discovered, that this is not a mythological text. It's one rooted in history and being verified over and over and over again by archaeology and other history. Now, one question on your mind might be, well, what about the miracles in the Bible? So maybe you're even with me so far, be like, okay, I can buy that the Bible is generally reliable in its history. But what about the miracles that are there? and maybe you've heard this. Carl Sagan is famous. He didn't originate this, but he was famous for popularizing this phrase. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So he's like, okay, miracles are so extreme. How do you expect me to believe that? We just don't see miracles happening all over the place. For him and others, the fact that the very fact that there's miracles in the Bible automatically discredits it. It cannot be true because it claims miraculous things. And so therefore you need so much evidence to overturn it for me to believe it. And I remember even my anthropology professor one time, I asked him, like, well, what would it take you to believe, you know, about Christianity? He's like, I would only believe it if God came down and appeared in front of me and told me that it was true. And then I said, I'm like, really? Would you believe it? Like, wouldn't you just say, oh, it was a hallucination? You know, I imagined it, you know? And you start to see that what people, the standard of evidence is so extreme that you almost can't, it's almost like there's an internal bias. Like, I just don't want to believe it. And nothing you can do can actually prove it to me. And so what happens, though, is that we have to say, there's a couple reasons for this. One is the worldview of naturalism. Basically, that only nature exists. There's nothing supernatural that exists. And so, therefore, if there's something supernatural in the Bible, then I can't trust it. But the thing is, that is not a valid position to take. Because first of all, how do you know that only nature exists? See, you would have to be God. You would have to have an infinite mind to know that. So if you're going to take that as an absolute stance, that's actually an irrational position to take. Right? And the thing is, I think there's good reasons to believe that God does exist through nature and all these other things. I mean, the fact that there's face mites actually astounds me. Never knew about face mites. The complexity of nature, etc. I can do another seminar some other time about how we know God exists. But the thing is, you can't establish that. So the thing is, you should be open to at least the possibility of miracles. The possibility of miracles. And now, though, when you combine that with a generally reliable account, that should at least give you reasons to investigate it, to ask more questions, to say, wow, you know, most people, when they make up things, there's so many errors and falsehoods all around them. But the Bible is a generally, just from what we can verify, is a generally reliable historical document. Now, you might say, well, there's all like kinds of false claims. There's all kinds of hoaxes. Like, how do I know what to believe? But again, you should think about that. There's a professor that mentions this. His name is Robert Lamar. He says, he counters with this. He says that testimony is sometimes of questionable worth, hardly establishes that it is always of questionable worth. Right? The testimony is sometimes of questionable worth, hardly establishes that it is always of questionable worth. Right, so just because sometimes witnesses lie or mistake things doesn't mean that they always are doing that. But that's what you feel like when people look at the Bible. They just say, oh, well, it just can't be true. Right, you just sort of throw it out wholesale. But that again, that's not a reasonable position to take. Because testimony sometimes is true, even of pretty amazing things that may only happen once in history or incredibly improbable. Right, so when we look at the Bible, we can actually say, okay, I should give this a shot. Like, I shouldn't let those assumptions keep me from looking at the evidence that's there, about Jesus and his resurrection and who he is. I want to investigate that. Right, so we look at this, we see that it's a trustworthy document, trustworthy history, but also a trustworthy portrayal. And I just, we'll go through real quick on this, a trustworthy portrayal of humanity. I don't know about you, but when you look at the Bible, it just seems very real. Right, like actually hits us, and it's realistic to the way life actually happens. And one thing that's really striking to me in the Bible is that there are failings of almost all the major characters recorded. That there's some kind of moral lapse or failure, the way they screw up or something. And that is pretty surprising. Think about it. If you want to make up a religion and you want to be the leader of it, like you want to convince people of it, I mean, take Apostle Peter for an example, right? If you know Peter's story, right, throughout the whole Gospels, he's like, Jesus, I'm going to die for you. I believe in you. Like, you know, even if everybody else leaves you, I won't leave you. What happens when it comes time to put his money where his mouth is? Right, he rejects Jesus. He even like three times says, I don't even know the guy when Jesus is on trial and people are trying to accuse him of being with Jesus. That seems to be not a smart thing to do if you want to be a leader of a church and deceive people and make up a story about yourself. Like, why would you do that? Like, I would make myself the hero. Like, everybody else did fall away, and I was the one who, oh, faithful, follow me. I can tell you what Jesus really said. Listen to me, like, you know, follow. Like, it's just improbable. And you know what, though? That makes sense the way life really is. Because when we look at our lives, we see that we are flawed too, right? So when it starts portraying people as perfect and like these saints, that should give us pause, be like, wait a second, doesn't correspond to the way things really are. Nobody's perfect, except, right, the only person that was perfect was Jesus, right? That's how he could die in our place, right? And you look at your life, you see it all the time. My one son saw something scary at the Bloomsburg Fair and been waking up for 3 weeks in a row at night, waking us up. And I'm getting so tired. And I like to think I'm growing in my patience. But the fifth time he comes into our room and I'm so tired, I'm just like, and I start to get angry. I'm like, get back in your bed. You know, and I'm like, I'm constantly reminded, right? Like, we're flawed. Like, I like to think I'm better than I am, but I'm not. Right? And the Bible portrays, that's the way the Bible portrays us. That's realistic to the way things really are. And it's unlikely that you would make up this kind of story. And the last thing is just a trustworthy portrayal of God. I probably should have put a question mark at the end of this. Some of you might be here and you might say, well, I see a lot of things about God I like in the Bible, but there's a lot of things I don't like. There's a lot of things that God has done that I don't agree with, or things he says, right? And you might actually say, well, that in and of itself makes me not want to read it and not even give it a chance. But let me ask you this. Should we expect that God, in everything he says and does, is going to be revealed to us in a way that exactly fits everything that we think about reality? That God is going to fit every category that we think he should be? Hey, we're like, I appreciate what Joel was saying this earlier. Like, God is like this immense creator of the whole universe. Like, we're nothing to him. Like, how are we going to actually understand him fully? And how are we going to come to him and say, yeah, you should be like this and that, right? And that we're just going to get it right. It would be likely that things that he reveals about himself are going to be shocking. They're going to be maybe at times offensive at first until maybe we look into them further. Now, I would encourage you, if there's things in the Bible that offend you, that you should look into them and say, okay, examine those. Maybe you're misunderstanding them. There's even things that I start to read through the Bible. I'm like, why does God say that? Or why did he do that? But the more I study, I'm like, oh, okay. That makes sense. I still might not like it because I'm implicated in that too, my own weaknesses or sin. But I can understand why God does it. Right? I encourage you guys to pursue it and read it more. And I just think the portrait of Jesus is just amazing. Right? You have this man who... You almost feel like that God himself is being revealed when you read about Jesus, because you have this guy who is, at one hand, so merciful and loving and caring and welcoming in outsiders and people who are just on the fringes of society that nobody cares about, right? And he's like forgiving of them. But on the other side, he's sometimes extremely blunt, extremely like, you know, this is the way it is. You guys need to repent of your sins and turn away. And you see like the streak of justice in him, right? You see all these attributes in Jesus that you're like, how does these all exist in one person? But see, what happens, we start to realize what the Bible is portraying is somebody who's not just an average person, but he's a divine person, right? It's God, right? And the more you study Jesus and read about him, you'll see that. And the thing that's pretty amazing is that Jesus, right, he died for us, that he like laid down his life for us, right? And no other religion do you see it. There's even some, there's some other stories of dying like and rising, people rising from again. But in no other story does the main character or the God or whatever die for somebody else. He dies for himself and comes back to life for himself. He doesn't die for other people. And there's no other story like that in all of literature. So I think when we look at the Bible, we have a trustworthy document. We have a trustworthy, that we can trust what's actually written. We can trust the history that's in it. And we can trust the portrayal of it, that of God. And I just want to close with this. You know, in our house, we have street sweepers that come. And on, basically, when the street sweeper comes, there's signs along the road that says, today, this side of the street is going to be swept. So you got to move your car over to the other one. If you don't, you get ticketed, right? So this week, I woke up early on Thursday morning, and I'm like, oh, man, we forgot to move. I never wake up early, too. It was just weird. I woke up, and I said, I got to move the cars over. Like, both our cars were on our side of the street. So I got up and moved them over, and I felt pretty proud of myself that I caught that, you know? And then I'm like, I'm going to make Lynn coffee and get stuff ready for her, my wife. And, you know, then I started really feeling proud of myself. Like, you know, I did the, like, I'm like, this is great, you know? Like, I'm such a good husband. And then what happened is the next day, I had to move the cars back over because then they sweep the other side of the street. So Thursday, our side, Friday, so you got to kind of swap, and we don't have off-street parking at our house. It's one of the things it's not that bad, but that's what we have. And so we moved them over. Well, we woke up the next morning, and to our surprise, the street sweeper comes up the street, and it's on our side of the street. And the policeman is like, he's like right behind that street sweeper. And he can write a ticket in seriously like 30 seconds. Maybe 20 seconds he can write the ticket. Bam, and we're like sitting there like, what is going on? And I was annoyed the previous day because I thought they didn't even come. I was like, the street never got swept and I moved the cars for nothing. Well, you know what happened? That whole week, I had been totally messed up. I don't know if you ever had it where that week you kind of keep thinking it's the different day, like it's like Wednesday and not Thursday or Thursday and not Friday or something. Well, I did that earlier in the week. So I was totally wrong. When I moved the cars, it was really Wednesday, not Thursday. And then I moved them back on the wrong day and put them right where in the path of the meter maid. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, and we got two tickets. And I'm like, Lynn, I'm sorry. So I didn't feel so proud at that moment. I totally screwed this up. But one thing I realized, you know what, those signs, the whole time the signs were right, right? What was wrong was my assumptions, right? It's things that I had assumed about what was written that were wrong. And what I want to encourage all of you guys is think about this. Like maybe what you've assumed is wrong about the Bible. Maybe you're coming at it with a grid that is mistaken. And as you work through that and process through that, you actually see the Bible for what it really is. So I encourage you, because the Bible is a trustworthy book, to examine its claims and keep digging into it further and further. Well, I'm going to stop there, and we have about 15 minutes for questions. So there'll be some mic runners going. Just hold up, try to hold the microphone close to your, not, you know, you don't have to put it in your mouth, you know, like, but get it close so that we can hear you and it can get recorded for people listening later. So if you have any questions about try to keep it on subject with the Bible and this issue that we're talking about. I'd love to try to answer them for you, if I can. Any questions? Right over there.
Hey, Mike. I really appreciate what you were sharing. One thing that's hard for me about just understanding the trustworthiness of the scriptures was my senior year at Gettysburg, I had a professor of New Testament put a lot of particularly the Gospels against each other.
Yes.
And saying that these disagree. So how would you respond to that? How would you?
Is the assumption that like there's differences in the Gospels,
yeah,
and mm-hmm. so therefore they're not credible?
So this is Luke's account, this is John's account,
right.
This is Mark's account. Yeah.
Yes. Well, there's a couple things to keep in mind about that. And it's funny how this has been turned into a negative, right? So like I said, it seems, wouldn't it be a positive if there's more accounts rather than less accounts of somebody's life, because then you get more perspectives and more verification? So one, I would say, one, it's a positive that there's different accounts. Now, what about there may be differences in the accounts of themselves, right? Well, one of the things you have to realize is as they are writing history, especially at that time, many of the authors would write thematically. And so they don't think like us as much, where we write chronologically, where we just trace out, right, from somebody's born, and then you go through all this, and then they die, and you just trace out a chronology. They didn't do that back then. They actually wrote more like thematically, and this is just common in the writing of that day. So what happens, things will seem like they're in different orders sometimes in the Gospels, but what they're trying to do is write in this particular theme about Jesus' life, or a particular aspect about Jesus. And so that's why there's often differences in the Gospel and the way they're organized. We tend to think that modern day, we quote exactly, right? So if I put some of those quotes I put up there and I actually, they changed them a little bit, you would say, Mike, like, that's not good scholarship. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're changing the wording. Back then, when people quoted, they thought it was perfectly legitimate to not just basically summarize what people say, summarize it truthfully, right? Not summarize it with like things people didn't say, but they would summarize the gist of what people said, particularly because they didn't have like easy ways to write. So they had to just distill things down because they had to write by hand. Paper wasn't really invented. There was just papyrus and things like that then. So what they did is they made summaries of it, truthful summaries, but summaries. So that's why too, like you'll see those slight wording differences in the Gospels. And things like that. And that's just because that's the way historians wrote then. You see that with Thucydides, who wrote the Peloponnesian War, and other scholars at that time. I almost think Luke, too, almost followed Thucydides' method and how he wrote his history, because there's a lot of similarities in the method of writing the history. Last thing is that the differences that you see in the Gospels, what I encourage you, if you think there's a contradiction, right, you think that one says one says another, I encourage you to like look into each one. Right, just actually research to say, is there any possible way to resolve this? Because, you know, in all scholarship, you want to be charitable to the author. Just be like, not assume that they just contradicted themselves. Like, maybe they're saying something I'm not quite getting yet. You want to actually dig into each instance and, like, evaluate it and say, is there a way to resolve this? A famous one is, like, you know, one of the Gospels will say that there's two angels. Another one just says an angel. Right, but you say, well, if there was one angel and one, or if there was two angels, the one that says an angel said, it doesn't mention there were two, but if there's two, then there could have been one, right? It's not a contradiction. It's just that author decided just to focus on what the one angel was saying, didn't mention that there was two angels at the tomb, right? And that's not a contradiction. If one gospel said there is only one angel at the tomb and the other one says there was two angels, then that'd be a contradiction, right? But it's not a contradiction to say, right, that there's one of them said this versus there being two, right? So there's usually ways to resolve those contradictions and even actually show they're not contradictions. So those are a few things to think about. Another question right here along the aisle.
Son?
Hello?
Oh, hello. Yeah. So my one question is, well, I guess it's more of just trying to apply this better. So it's one thing, as you had kind of said in the first two points that's kind of setting this up, it's kind of one thing to claim ignorance. So it's to say, okay, so maybe these things could be true.
Uh-huh.
I'll get rid of my reservations.
Right.
It's a totally another thing to take something that you think is a stretch and then to say, I'm going to adopt this now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get the
correct
what I mean?
Yep.
So yeah, to say, okay, so maybe that could be true versus I believe this now.
Right.
So what are some questions as you're approaching the scriptures? Like if you want to study it more or understand it better, what are some questions that one could keep on their mind? Maybe if you're trying to help somebody else understand the scriptures better or you yourself, what are some key questions or things to think about as you're approaching the scriptures?
If I think I'm understanding, so you're saying certain things might clear away objections,
right.
But what does help us for like some of the positive reasons
right,
to accept?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I started hitting at the end, you know, yeah. like that there's, I think because the Bible does reveal things about life, right, that gets things about humanity, human nature, and other things, right, and especially as opposed to other religions and other philosophies, whether it's atheism or whether it's Islam or Hinduism, when you start to look at the way it portrays us and it talks about the fallenness of humanity, talks about the need for redemption, like fundamental things, even some of the ethics, that you start to see that there's that this is desirable to believe, but that it sort of, like I said, it gets in the truth of our experience. Like it hits me where I am, right? And so not only is it just truth out there, but it actually is pointing to truth that's in here, like things that I need to wrestle with and deal with, right? And so, and another thing that's true about, that it says in the Bible, is that there's the third person of the Trinity, right, the Holy Spirit. So what happens is when you actually are looking at the Bible, right, that God's Spirit actually can works through that and actually is one of the things that helps convince us it's true. Right. It doesn't mean that we just sort of just say, well, I just take it all in faith and I'll just believe it. Like there's good reasons to believe it, but like you can't prove everything, right? There's some things we just can't verify or prove. So the thing is the Holy Spirit works in us to help us to see it. So I would just say like, it's just, if it's really true, if it really is God's word, if this was God said, it's going to hit us in a way when we actually bring the message of it. It's going to become convincing, or some people are just going to say, you know what, I don't want it. And that's true also. The Bible shows that sometimes people reject it. So we shouldn't be upset about that. So I don't know, that's sort of vague, but hopefully that was helpful. Right here. Yeah, I know. It sounds... Can you guys hear? Just go ahead. Okay. I'll repeat it for the question anyway.
Pretty much what I found is scholars, there's a lot of debate on the authorship of different books.
Yes.
I was reading Ecclesiastes, and from just reading Ecclesiastes, I could say, oh, well, this is by Solomon. But then other scholars would say, oh, no, this is like a literary technique used by someone else saying, oh, we are scholars, and that's what we're writing for. Like,
uh-huh. Right. So what do we do with like just arguments about different authorships to the books? Yeah, it's a good question. Some of it is just, it's going to take some scholarship and study to look into each one of them. But I think there's other ways to go about it. So sometimes what you can do is you just work backwards. So you could say, okay, so we have good evidence for the Jesus and the New Testament. If Jesus really was a son of God, and Jesus literally, he affirms like the books in the Old Testament that the Jews had at that time. He affirms them and says they were true. If he really was a son of God, then he would know, right, whether they're false or not. So even if we can't discern every single detail of when exactly they're written, who wrote them, you know, we have some pretty good, you know, evidence, you know, and then the Bible actually speaks of those things itself. It'll say Isaiah said, you know. So, yeah, I don't think exactly the authorship is too big of a problem to overcome. And I would just approach each one individually and say, okay, are these arguments legit, you know, or not, you know? But that's why the Bible is sort of treated as like a whole. And so as even if you prove some of the books and some of those books actually speak of other books, then you could say they're reliable. You know, you can work backwards like that. But yeah, there are a few books that we're actually not sure who the authors were. And that is a legitimate thing that scholars are continually trying to figure out, you know, who actually wrote those books. So hopefully that's helpful. Over here. Take one or two more.
Hello. Oh, it's on. Okay. So I know there's a difference between like the Catholic Bible and the Protestant mm-hmm. Bible. How can we trust that we have the right canon mm-hmm. of books? Mm-hmm. Like, why did we take out the ones that we did?
Yeah, that's a big issue, is like how was the Bible actually put together? How can we trust what we have and how they were selected? One thing about the Catholic Bible has the Apocrypha, it's called. There's the books of Maccabees, Wisdom of Solomon, others, right, that were put in. Those were actually added in by the Catholic Church later after the Reformation in the 1500s. So those were not included by the church as a whole for all that time. And part of the reason why those books were included, and I think Catholics will even say this, is that because they were responding to some of the arguments by Protestants. And so some of the things in those books actually responded to arguments from Protestants. But those books were never included for a long time. And there's really good evidence that many of those books, those books itself don't actually claim to be inspired. Even at the end of the book of Maccabees, 2 Maccabees, the author says, I did my best to portray history and to relate it to you. He goes, I may have made mistakes, but I've done my best job. And so when you just read it, you're like, okay, the other books of the Bible, they say, like, this is God's word. This is true. It's not an error, stuff like that. And so like those books don't even seem, they're not even really claiming to be inspired from God. So that's why Protestants don't include those books in. And the other question is really just when you go back, how are the books chosen? It's a lot to describe. There's one book I can show you. It's called Who Chose the Gospels? So it kind of goes through how do we actually get the gospels that we have, because there are some other gospels that were written that people have been claiming, like the book of Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Judas. You may have heard of some of those. But one is that oftentimes these other books were written way later than the actual writings, so in the second and third century. So you could say, okay, these weren't written by the original witnesses. And even most scholars would date those books later, right, that they were written later. So we would say, well, we probably shouldn't include those books in. And when you go back, actually, you see that early church leaders, the books that we have now as considered the canon of books, like the established books, that these are the biblical books, they were went back very early into the church of the books that we have now, and even some of the church leaders were mentioning those books early on, even in their quotes or their writings. And so we kind of say, okay, like the early church, who the second generation who knew the apostles, right, who wrote the books, who are passed down, they were already quoting those books and saying that these are the books that are like the actual writings from God. So that's a short answer. There's a lot of scholarship. The one book, it's tedious. He goes through all this evidence, but you know, you got to do it. If you want to really do good scholarship, you got to go through all that evidence, you know, and see. So I think we could say we have good confidence that the books that we have, you know, are what was actually the books that should have been included in the Bible. So, I mean, I guess it's always possible we could find another one that would fit, but, you know, that's questionable. So maybe one more question and we'll wrap up. Anybody else have a question about the Bible or anything along those lines? None. Cool. Well, I don't see any more. So why don't we wrap up? Thanks, guys, for coming and listening. And I'm going to be here for a few minutes, so just if you have any other questions, you want to ask me any questions, I can show you some books that I have that are really helpful that I would really recommend if you want to read more on this subject. So thanks a lot for coming, and God blessings to you.
You've been listening to Teaching from Disciple Makers. To learn more about Disciple Makers, check out our website at www.dm.org. Follow us on Twitter at Disciple Makers, or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Disciple Makers. Disciple Makers, reaching the campus, reaching the world.